Hello, everyone, and welcome to another episode of the Comics Fondle podcast. My name is Andrew, and my blog is comicsfondle.com.
And this is Vernon, and my retail store operation is called the Comics Gallery of Wilmette, Illinois.
And this is our monthly-ish podcast where we talk about everything comics. Well, maybe not. We don't talk about everything comics. We talk about a lot of things comics.
Right.
And then we get off on tangents.
Yeah, not too bad though. Not too bad. This is going to intended audience, perhaps, but who knows? We don't want to stereotype Vern's reading habits. But this is a kind of an interesting, cartoony drawn. Slice of life comic about three girls who share a dormitory in college. And it's written by a guy, John Allison, and it's really nicely rendered by Lisa Treeman, I think I'm pronouncing her name right. But anyway, they both do a really good job, like depicting college life among three mature young ladies and their relationships with guys. And And they're all drawn really nicely, uniquely, and different in a very consistent style. And I think what I liked about this book is it's humorous in intent, and it doesn't, you know, get into the pale or anything. It's more of a nice slice of life humor book, but it's done at such a nice consistency all the way through, a very professional effort. And I like the characters, and I'll be back for the second issue. And like I said, if you thought I was going to pick up a comic about, like, three college co-eds or something like that, you know, and their very mundane lifestyle, I'd say, I don't know about that one, you know, but Giant Days was actually pretty good. I'll be back for the second issue, and it's a six-issue mini anyway, but Boom
cool.
does it. About,
Boom, yeah, Boom, really? Does, okay, yeah. I'll have to, yeah, I can't believe that I somehow missed it in my in the review copies, but I will have to check that out.
Yeah, it was pretty nicely done, and I guess it was it might have even been was it digital first? I'm not sure. I don't know if Boom does that yet. Yeah, and I'd read some good review, and I says, okay, I'll check it out, and it turned out to be quite a pleasant experience.
That's good.
Yeah, so let's see. We're gonna continue onward with Andrew's pick here, Manifest Destiny, issue 14. What do you got to say about that one, anyway?
Manifest Destiny, issue 14. I have got to say that, you know, Manifest Destiny by issue 14 has established certain things, and we're going to talk about them later, I think, with some other comics, where they have a way that their cliffhangers work. And Manifest Destiny, in this case, is establishing again that its cliffhangers don't really work all that great.
Not every issue.
Not every issue, because there's this forced cliffhanger at some point in the issue. And this one's pretty bad because the cover refers to the cliffhanger.
Yeah,
Other than that, there's some really cool stuff in the issue, but it is just sort of building up to the next. The comic's pretty loose with story arcs, but it's building up to the next story arc. There's the adorable blue bird whose mother comes looking for it, which is kind of funny, but... I'm guessing mother, just because, you know, it tends to be the mother. But yeah, I mean, it's a good issue otherwise, you know, the end
beginning,
right?
Someone's gonna eat the dust, and it's almost to the point now where they got to find some unity of purpose here and get on with the, what would this be, the final arc or close to it? I'm hoping.
Well, because, is it? No, it can't be, because it's got to mirror Lewis and Clark's journey.
Well,
I feel like
we're losing a couple of crew members every comic. So, like, how many have they got to keep going on? You know what I mean?
Well, that depends. I don't know the story of Lewis and Clark.
Well, I'm pretty sure they made it back.
Well, they did make it back, except, I should know the story of Lewis and Clark, shouldn't I? But anyway, they made it back, but I feel like it depends on how well the book's going to do. I mean, it's got to – they're – journey is a matter of history. We could look it up. We're just too lazy. We could know how long this could conceivably go on for. We just have yet to do so.
There's also the payoff of Lewis and Clark themselves and about how deeply we are ingrained as to caring about their mission.
Right.
You know, and we're 14, is it? 14 in? Yeah.
Yeah.
And they've got to either keep up the pace that they've established, or they got to figure out how to come to some type of graceful ending here or something anyway.
I don't know. I mean, it depends, and we could do the research on this, and we won't. But if they work it out, I could see him going to 50, but yeah, otherwise, 24 seems the right spot.
Yeah, because like I say, I'm not going to give spoilers here away. If you've read, you know that like a crewman or two disappear in every issue, and it's a matter of like, you know, hey, how many are left? You can start.
Maybe they re-up at some point, you know?
Yeah. Hey, come on, guys, more slave guys or whatever it is. Yeah, but kind of a passing, you know. I don't know. Ultimately, it was a good issue, I guess, but you know, not what you call it striking. You know, sometimes
no, like this book, yeah. But,
well, hey, I finally got Red Satellite Sam number 13, man.
Okay.
Yeah, just before the podcast. And did you get to read that one yet?
I did.
Okay, good. Because I hate to give reveals to you. I don't really care about the listeners, but I just don't want to give you reveals. But you know what? This was kind of like a really one of those big, heavy issues where we go from just like exposition to the whole point of this whole torted, sordid thing.
Yeah.
And this guy, what's the protagonist? Is it Michael?
Michael, yeah.
Yeah. He's taken more and more control of his destiny, and I'm not sure it's for the positive or the negative here, you know? He wants to get to the bottom of his father's death. And for those of you, I don't want to bore everybody who listens to this. Satellite Sam is about a TV show in the 50s, and the main character is a fellow who's filling in for his dad who died mysteriously. It's kind of a whodunit murder mystery and sexual fetish type, everybody's involved with everybody type stuff. But 13 continued along pretty good. I think we're really starting to bang all the drums, and Fraction seems to be finding a way to bring this to some type of conclusion. The politician Kearns, he comes in as a much more forceful presence in this issue because he's always seen kind of a nebbishy politician, and this issue he gets proactive. And I don't know, like what about the here's a good one I'm going to ask you. What about that Italian conversation?
I know the all Italian Godfather homage. That was pretty cool.
Yeah, it goes on for like 4 pages or something where you're reading it and you're trying to imagine what the hell they're saying, you know.
And once you figure it out, you can kind of get it. Yeah.
We've all seen enough movies and stuff. But yeah, Satellite Sam 13 came out, fills up the expectations. Howie Chaykin pulls up his end of the stick. And, you know, it's a very satisfying read. It really is one of those kind of reads, I think, that cements Matt Fraction as one of the writers.
It does. And it's nice because he's sort of moved past the point. Where...
Oh, yeah. Yeah.
He's back on board. He's getting to draw fetish, kinky, just really kinky stuff this issue. And you can tell how he's engaged.
Oh, man. Sex with an elderly lady. It doesn't get better than that. Outrageous stuff. Satellite Sam takes no prisoners and asks for none, you know. You know, and it's amazing. We even talked about this earlier. Matt Fraction's ability, like even when Howie Chaykin had his art lapse, that the script from Fraction just carries it through all the way through. You know, you're so fascinated by the written word and what it says in relationship to the visuals that this book just runs on all 6 cylinders most of the time. It's a real pleasure.
Yeah, it's an excellent book.
Yeah, oh, God stuff. But speaking of creepy stuff, I'm sure some of our customers are saying, oh, these guys are talking about sex too much. But creepy stuff's coming up, though. you get it, finally got a hold of an Archie publication. They don't publish too often.
Yeah, they don't publish too often, but here we go. We've got Sabrina, issue number 2. Really creepy comic book.
Super fucking.
I mean, you know, the whole vibe of the Roberto Aguirre, Santos?
Sarcaza,
him too. His whole vibe with the Archie comics seems to be to do color versions of black and white Marvel horror books from the 70s. There's a very retro vibe to it, and it's it just works out really nicely. And so with this issue, how to say this? What he seems to be doing is he's setting up the villain, but he's also, the way Sabrina is treated, Sabrina is... You know, a good guy, right? But her aunts are very creepy, and they have that horror aspect to it. The father was a creep, you know, and like the villain has a, you know, perfectly justifiable excuse. You know, she was, yeah, she was thrown over for a human because the father wanted to creep too far. I mean, this, the villain's eyes are death's heads. I mean, it's just, it's disturbing shit.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, even the little light touches when she enters the forest, the Madam Satan, and she goes, and I take my shoes off and walk barefoot because I'm out of respect. And I'm like, man, even that's creepy.
Yes, it's just, and that's like half the issue. Then the other half of it is working, her working her way into Sabrina's life. And that's just, oh, it's awesome. It's an awesome comic. That Archie's able to do these horror books is excellent. It's a shame that their superhero books didn't work out, but we're not going to really go into that because nobody should waste their time. So instead, Vernon's going to talk about Crossed 100 without any spoilers.
Oh, man.
Because I haven't read it yet.
Okay. Thank you for telling me. Well, you know what? Alan Moore's continuation of Garth Ennis's post-apocalyptic ego and the id type apocalyptic atmosphere, the whole thing, continues on nicely with Forever meeting her, what would you call it, like this small town that they communicate with, and they're more Muslim-based.
Okay.
You know, he meets her counterpart over there, and it's okay. A pretty good meet. And, you know, I can't help but to say overall that this Alan Moore treatment, it radiates hope despite the difficult situation these people exist in. They're trying to team up with the town over to get rid of the crazy people. That's what we've established already, and whether or not they can do this. And this overall hopeful tone that Moore gives the series, I have a feeling that he's getting ready to really screw us over here because this is our You know, and it's just because, you know, each chapter begins with her writing and ends with her writing.
Right.
More later at the end of every chapter. It's like this reoccurring phrase that just lulls you into the whole dreamy sleepland story of it. And you know that you're getting fucked over because this is the crop. Chapter 3, Forever found some disturbing artifacts among the infecteds. Okay, that led her to believe that someone was thinking about what they were doing or had motives or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
And that continues on when she shares her discoveries with this other archivist from the other town. And it turns into, for about 5 minutes, it turns into a kind of an interesting murder mystery. And I know you're gonna like this part because it comes right after a chapter or a few pages that knock your socks off because of its avatarness. And I'll leave it at that.
Oh, good.
Yeah, yeah, it's a great comic, and for those of you that can hang with post-apocalyptic gross stories of survivors that are trying to live and grow older in this world, it's definitely for you. It's horror, but it's just so wonderfully done. And I haven't even mentioned the artist. God, what the hell's this guy's name? He's one of their big guys, Gabriel Andrade. I'm probably mangling the guy's name, but he does a wonderful job of picking apart things and introducing them into a village that where you believe these people could survive and live and prosper. It's not Jack Kirby drawing a post-apocalyptic. It's a guy thinking about what it would really look like and how a village would look like and stuff like that with a little farming and all that. So it's a hellish comic. It's going good. It's going to kill us. I know Alan Moore is not going to let us off easy because he's not that kind of guy. And he hasn't returned to comics for without a reason. You know, wouldn't that be wild that he just like comes back and says, I'm going to scare the shit out of all of you. This will teach you to fuck with Alan Moore anymore. You know? Shit. All right. Well, I'm going to let you have with the next one. That's our another one of our science fiction titles.
Letter 44, number 15. So letter 44, number 15 jumps ahead 3 months with the first titled story arc on the front cover. It's called Dark Matter. It's World War III, Obama versus Bush, with the Germans backing Bush, and we don't get to see the president this issue. We get to see him for a second, but not long enough for it to matter.
It's odd.
And there's no follow-up with his wife and her behind-the-scenes stuff. There's a lot with the aliens. And it ends with another ill-advised full-page spread from the artist who really can't handle those. And, you know, it feels almost like a different comic because the astronauts are living in the space station, the alien space station. Feels very much like Arthur C. Clarke, and
it definitely skirts like mainstreamness on the edge here.
Yeah.
We're very, very dangerously close to mainstream comics here.
Yeah, so it'll be interesting to see. And, I mean, it's had a good run. I guess we shouldn't be surprised if it has some problems. And next up, Vernon and I are both going to talk about Lazarus 16 because it's one of these rare comics that Vernon, like, I think you texted me about it. And you're like, dude, did you read the end of Lazarus? And I was like, no, I got bored with the nun story and was like, why the hell did they do this?
You just don't like nuns, admit it.
It's Greg Rucka doing a fill-in.
Well, yeah, it's definitely a fill-in issue.
It's a fill-in issue because Lark doesn't even drop out for that much. He only drops out for maybe 8 pages, but I guess
right.
When you're looking at 22, that's enough, right?
Wow. Yeah, he still illustrated the book, but he got off a little lighter. So
yeah, and, you know, it's like a little bit of texture, little bit of sort of side story. The war has broken out, and we're seeing it from this nun who's a spy's perspective. You know, it's all right. You know, it's just a fill-in. You don't have to think about it too much. It'll refer back in a couple issues, probably not the next one. Rucka doesn't do fill-ins the way Ed Brubaker does. They both worked on Gotham Central, but the Rucka fill-ins were nothing compared to the Brubaker fill-ins, and it's still the case with Brubaker.
Yeah, Brubaker does his best work in one issue. He really does.
Poor guy.
Yeah,
and he does, and it's true, and it's sad, but what are you going to do?
Well, yeah, Lazarus is
but then but Vernon's going to talk about all the awesome stuff that I didn't read at the end of the comic.
Well, you know, Rucka gave the letter column over to Michael Lark, which immediately, if you're an art wank, you're just like tuning in on this stuff because you want to hear about how his processes work and to what extent he uses photography, because obviously he does use photography, but he does pencil everything in and get it inked. And I thought it was a good definition of his workload and how it works. And it was really fascinating to experience this. I liked the graphic work. I mean, the fill-in issue, what we're talking about, is these 8 pages were kind of grafted these graphic fill-ins like IDs and computerish visualizations of things that narrative went over. Incidentally, I did want to mention that I had to use my iPad here, because I wanted to close in on the written journal more so I could read it. I couldn't read it in comic book form. And
wow.
I just put it on my iPad and blew it up, and I could read it. And that was great. So I had mixed bag with the issue. I wasn't quite as disappointed, but it is a fill-in issue. But a fill-in issue with Greg and Lark is still better than, 80% of comics.
Okay, so next up, Vernon's going to take Luther Strode, which you can't do any spoilers on because I haven't read it either.
Did you read the first 2 volumes?
I think I read the first 2 volumes. Liked the first one, didn't like the second one.
Well, I think it's pretty clear by now that Justin Jordan is not a writer. I mean, he's tried very hard. And you know what? He has these, oh my God, they're mesmerizing drawings that just show like an unhappy obsession with curves and, I don't know, nightmarish visions. It's just really nice stuff. He really exaggerates the human form and gets away with it every time because his line work and composition are just so sweet. This guy could do a million posters. I think every visual out of here is a poster. And the colorist, Felipe Sobrero, does a good job as well. This thing is eye candy. It's like, what is it? What's it? Andrew's a film auteur. So I'd say this would be the equivalent of like Furious 7 or something like that. So that's what Luther Strode is to me. It's kind of like Furious 7 on comics, and we're waiting for this sequel. And so far, so good. It's not deep, but it's fun. Let's leave it at that.
All right.
I'm gonna
okay, so Curb Stomp, which is a fun one, because Vernon, have you read it yet?
I read the third one, so go ahead and talk. You can have
some okay, time. So Curb Stomp 1, read it. Was kind of impressed, liked it. It was an interesting sort of felt like homage a little bit to Love and Rockets. You know, it was cool. Second issue, not cool. Second issue did not work out at all. And I was just like, I almost didn't read the third issue, which is just awesome. And it's just frustrating because...
there's one more to go.
There's one more to go, and who knows how well they'll do with it. But, yeah, the third issue of Curb Stomp, it's gang politics, it's...
It does
betrayal. Like, it's just awesome.
Right. I think the payoff for three is it actually pays off the type of interleague banter you got from these people as individuals.
Mm-hmm.
The second issue, when they had to do all action, it just failed horribly. But in that third issue where they really get into the interpersonal politics between each of them, that really makes it. And
yeah.
it lives up to its promise that issue one showed. Like, it's very strange. Like, this book starts off high, then hits the skids, and comes right back up with an actual better three than issue one.
I know.
You know? And you know, this time the production values actually help because they bring it up to like this surreal, hypertensive level that it wouldn't have had otherwise. So you might have more of a genuine chemistry between the writer and ours. Ryan Ferrer, we're going to have to keep an eye on him. You know,
yeah, I know. We're going to talk about him, yeah.
Great. Well, I assume Curb Stomp was a success with you then.
Curb Stomp is a success with me.
Yeah, I'm trying to think. I just was amazed with it overall. Let's just hope that fourth issue pays off, baby.
I know.
Great. All right, anyway, we're going to get to one. Now, this is where you have to separate the creators from their life. Because the creator, the writer is Brian Wood, who's had some checkered opinions about his behavior exist. And... you got to separate the writers. And, you know, so I'm like, I'm trying to go in here because you look at like some of the crazy lives that artistic people had in the history of the world. Okay. So I'm not going to judge Brian Wood. You may not like him as an individual. So I just try to read his comics. And I don't know. It was his new one, Rebels, with Andrea Muti, the artist, or Muti. I'm afraid. I don't know how to pronounce it well. Revolutionary War, he can. You could argue that the character, the main character and his wife, it's a little soapy, but I guess we'll put it off. We'll see how the second issue does. You know, I wouldn't want it to be about like Hill Street Blues of the American Revolutionary War and like that. But, you know, so far the first issue I liked. I'm into the history. I think the artwork is pretty solid. How did you feel about it? I know you were less.
I still haven't read it.
You still haven't read The Rebels?
It's okay, on my list. I still haven't read it.
Now, hey, here's one you did read. You can go.
Here's one I did read. Fade Out 5. So Fade Out 5 is probably my favorite issue of the series so far, just because it's the first one where Brubaker really shows an interest in figuring out this this movie studio in the 50s setting and like the reality of how that works. They go out on location, which... for this is a set built out in the, you know, forest somewhere. And so they're just out in the wilderness and they're away from their regular lives. And it's just really cool. And I feel like the end's a little too discreet with the car accident, not to spoil anything. But other than that, it's a really cool issue that mixes, you know, Brubaker doing talking heads with a lot of action, but not action.
Yeah. There's a lot that happens in this issue. I'd have to say, too, at the end, you're talking about the end, this catalytic action, that relates to my thing. Like, is it Gil? Now, Gil is the loser, right?
Yeah.
Yeah, what's the name of our protagonist? I don't know. I can't remember him. But the whole book is narrated and features the life of our protagonist and his good friend, a guy named Gil, who seems very self-destructive, but nonetheless provides that reason for the existence of the series here at the last panel when he undergoes this catalyst when this automobile accident happens. He's determined. And now we find out the book is not necessarily about our protagonist, but it's about Gil, perhaps.
Right.
And his efforts to affect things in his own life. And the fade out has some really powerful panels. The particular scene where the studio guard, who's kind of, keeping Gil under wraps, talks about one of the movie stars he had to keep an eye on and the great lengths he got this guy to keep him on a leash for as far as personal behavior was concerned. And that was a pretty powerful piece of thing. I have no doubt whatsoever that shit probably really existed. It seems very logical, you know. How did you feel about the back and forth between the historical and the what do you call it, the present day stuff was pretty powerful too. I don't know. This book seems to be like one of the most technically complicated of all comic books.
Yes, Satellite Sam, and this one didn't start out that way. It seemed far more standard Hollywood during the McCarthy era stuff, but Brubaker's really shown a lot of texture to it lately.
Oh, the amount of balls he's able to juggle with this thing is just amazing, with the girl's story and how it leads into like, oh yeah, this is how it was when I was first up here at the party on the hill and all that kind of crap. It was really scary.
Yeah.
Fade Out. I agree fully. It's like one of the most structured, deep, complicated comics on the stands. And I like the way you said it didn't start out that way. It started out very genre-ish, very well done genre, but this is where it got elevated to the next level story-wise, to where I really care, because you're really, really fully vested into the reason of the series now. So good for these guys. Let's hope they can take it.
Yeah.
Onward to our next masterpiece, Mark Millar's Jupiter Circle. Dun, dun, dun. You know, what is it? We talk about media, and I'm sure we'll talk about Millar later more in depth or whatever about it, but can the guy, like, really do anything except for a perfect script that's made to be developed into other media? Answer me that one. Because, I don't know.
I don't think it's his primary goal, no.
Oh, okay. Well, either way, if it's art, well, he succeeds.
Well, no, I mean that his primary goal is to develop it into other media.
Right, exactly, because it's just ingenious, because what, arguably he's the most successful comics writer today, right?
Certainly, yeah. I mean, of anybody who's mildly independent, yes.
Yeah, because you want to be in his shoes. You may not like the material he writes, and it may not be original or necessarily interesting all the time, but you do like the man gets his paycheck and the fact that he gets to do what he wants, pretty much. Now, Jupiter Circle is probably a worthy sequel. It's actually a prequel to the other one. Torres, who's a very decent artist, cartoonist, very pop artist style, kind of Lichtensteiny. And they get through it all right. It's a good story of the characters when they first became heroes. And it was like post-Depression era, getting close to it, with Hoover keeping on their tails, wondering who they were and all that kind of shit. And again, he succeeds. Between this and Chrononauts, you're not sure, like, can the guy, like, write a really horrible comic that I wouldn't want to read or tell anybody to read? He's batting 1,000. It's just ridiculous. It's crazy, and I'm not gonna recommend it. See, that's weird. This is a writer I can't recommend, okay? But he's someone that I wouldn't say you shouldn't read either, because he's actually technically competent anyway. Anyway, we're gonna talk to somebody who is technically competent anyway. I'm going to let you handle Copperhead 6 anyway on that.
Oh, it's so good. It's the first issue of the new arc. It jumps ahead a little bit in the storyline because some things are different. The relationship between the sheriff and her deputies progressed and a little, and he's in a position where Faber's in a position where he can introduce the deputy's mate, and introduce his ambitions and things like that. It's very cool, and then there's more with her starting to date, which we'll see if that happens. There's a bit with her son still palling around with the
alien
android. No, that's an android, yeah. So, I mean, it's just still a really good book, and it's still really impressive, and I'm still just, again, somewhat shocked.
Yeah, it's a very multi-textured book. It's very deceptive on its surface. It delivers the goods by all the different characters and their motivations and their motives. I guess same thing. Sorry, I repeated myself. You know what was weird about this issue is you can see why she has problems with her son. She works an obscene amount of hours as a sheriff. And so what does she do when she gets a day off? No, I'm going to go drink at the bar. I was like, wow, I can see why your son cuts out all the time, you know? And did you pick that up? I mean, I was like, she doesn't have a very good relationship with her son. It's kind of sad, you know? So we'll have to see where that goes too, you know, because he even got her on the cover here. You know, it looks like she's had a few and she's ready for another one. And I was like, okay, this is another thing. You may not like the sheriff as much as you did the earlier issues. You
right.
know? Anyway, it's very riveting, good stuff. And
it's so nice this book is holding up. And I mean, a lot of this stuff that we've talked about this episode, Manifest Destiny, Satellite Sam, Letter 44, Lazarus, those are books that are getting into the middle of their second year. And I feel like part of the image renaissance, the indie comic renaissance of, you know, the 2010s, is that by the, you know, 12 issues plus, you start seeing a lot of problems.
Yeah.
And so it's been, you know, Copperhead had a problem a few issues ago, and it seems to have really turned around, and it's nice to see that, and it'd be nice if we have this to read again in 6 months.
Yeah, I agree with you. To sustain, like what was it, Manifest Destiny hit 14, and it at this point you can honestly say the danger point is when it feels like 14 issues. It shouldn't feel like 14 issues. You should just be kind of anxiously awaiting the next one. Mm-hmm. So it's a difficult road to hoe for an indie, especially with the lack of editors. So, you know, my hat's off to them anyway. Hopefully they can continue enough things to keep us interested. But Copperhead's good. So far, so good. No lack of ideas here, that's for sure.
Yeah.
All right. I think we should both work on Kaiju Max. I like your expression of it better. You should lead on this instead of me, I think.
Well, okay. What did I say? Hold on. Let me go look, everybody. It'll just be a second.
That's right. He's got to remember what he says. It's hard this time of the evening. Kaiju Max, you know? I mean, the big federal penitentiary of Japanese
should any monsters. Which part? Should it – any effort be spent trying to make sense of it, or the description of it as – you told me that it was a Monster Island as a prison camp. Yeah, I even say that. Yeah, and of course you like what I said in my post. It refers to you. There you go, everybody. Vernon showing his ego this evening.
Yeah, see, I got away with that one there. Didn't I? No, but Kaiju Max gets my vote for like probably the most fun title we've read in a while anyway. I've read anyway. I mean, it's kind of like Orange is the New Black with big Japanese movie monsters. It's really fun stuff to read.
It's fun, and, you know, well, Xander Cannon's somebody who, what was the first thing I ever saw him on? Was probably Top 10, and you form a certain opinion of him after Top 10.
Super inventive.
Very inventive, but also very formal on Top 10. Very formal. Top 10, you know, you almost thought of him as more of a Brian Boland reincarnation than he actually is. And so he's willing to have some fun. He actually did that with the S-Max series he did on his own. S-Max was nowhere near as finished as Top 10 was. But, yeah, it's a good little book. We'll see. It'd probably be funnier if he could have done it officially, but, you know, you got to do what you got to do.
Well, this way you don't have to go to deal with copyrights from other things, you know.
That's true.
And Kaiju Max just is very inventive, yet at the same time, there's a huge variety of monsters there, and all their motivations and backgrounds are different, and their power levels, and they all have their own pecking order. It's hard not to like a book like this. You're right. How long you can read it, well, that will depend on whether or not the story has resonance and whether it has a purpose. But right now, it's a great little monsters and prison story, and you know, the evil warden is, Ultraman, you know, and he grows up and he fucking wails on this one guy and pulls him by the tail and does a big circle and throws him across Monster Island in a bid to get him to shut up and get under control.
And that is just perfect because, you know, Ultraman is one of those things that I know I watched and I remember almost none of it.
You know, there wasn't enough to remember about Ultraman to care.
Okay, so Descender is more of the same, which is Jeff Lemire doing a highly derivative story of sci-fi movies, and Dustin Nugent doing some beautiful artwork.
Beautiful.
It's just a lovely-looking comic book set in the future. If you've seen a preview for the movie AI, you can figure out some of it. There's some more texture to it, but it really just is all about that art.
It, you know, it's a really nicely elegant-looking comic. The visuals just perfectly convey the storyline. It's up to Jeff Lemire whether he where he takes this, because so far, two issues in, you know, no problems. It's, you know, even the page-to-page narration where he makes you go back and forth does not stress on the reader at all. I mean, you really get wrapped up into that back and forth rhythm, and that's pretty hard to accomplish. I will give him points for doing.
Say, I can't see this going more than six. They're gonna.
No, it's a definite finite storyline. It doesn't beckon that much longer. You know what I mean? You're right. It's movie material, but you know it's kind of funny because. One half of me, you're torn because, okay, this is for development. This reads like a movie. But you know what? I'm really enjoying, like, reading it. It kind of goes down like marshmallows, if you like marshmallows, I guess. It really does. You don't have to work hard. You just got to go along with the flow, and it feels good. And I feel guilty for liking it, I guess you'd say. Well, you know, Dustin Nyan's artwork is just gorgeous stuff. I mean, he's putting out stuff here. If you like his stuff that he does for DC, you're like, man, he really throws out all the stops here with the drafts.
Right, and that's kind of cool to see because some of these guys aren't going to spend as much time on their creator-owned stuff as they do on their DC stuff because the money comes in so much differently.
Well, they better if they want it to succeed. I mean,
that's a good point.
Yeah, you got me reading this shit And you know, you can be derivative, but if you carry it off like this, I'll still read it.
Exactly.
You know, and that leads us to our next guy who does the same effing thing, Mark Millar with his Chrononauts, the second issue. You know, I will say after that first issue, Sean Murphy's art gets you through it a lot. And, you know, the whole thing is your typical jock star, time travel, we get to do what we want-ish, which gets amped up by issue two. Did you read issue two at all?
Not yet.
Not yet, okay. Well, The story takes just enough of a pivotal turn that keeps your Millarisms fully engaged. I guess that's the best way to put it. You know what I mean? Like he ups the ante, and it works fine. And you're like, okay, but it's a four issue mini. So again, one thing about Millar, he doesn't lack in bringing a lot of shit to the table that he's got to solve in four or five issues. This is only a four issue mini, and I'm like wondering. Well, he's got a lot of shit going on here. Can he finish it all up in four issues? You know, was it MPH proved to be a little dissatisfactory because he couldn't quite do that? So we'll see if he sets him up properly. But you know what? It's like one of those comics I can't not recommend. I mean, I think it's artfully done and it's worth your money. I mean, it's really nice. I'd rather read that than anything from Marvel or DC almost, you know. Anyway, I'll let you have Bad Girl 40, the last of the DC readable books, some of them.
Really? What do you mean? Why is it the last of them?
Well, part of not the last of them. There's not too many of the mainstream DC books that I even read anymore.
Okay, I thought you meant they canceled Batgirl with this team and they were going to relaunch her with something else.
Oh, no, they're not. I think they have too much luck with this.
And they really are. And DC just announced the other day they're selling them in comic book shops, Vernon. I think it's more for them to try to
bastards
to do it in bookstores to young adult audiences. But Batgirl 40 is an okay comic. It might remind readers of a certain movie called Captain America: The Winter Soldier because. There's a computer oracle who decides she's going to zap every bad person with lasers, just like in Captain America 2. But I think those were with big guns, but whatever. Other than that, it's all right. Tars, given the book a personality that it didn't previously have, it looks like Stewart's getting looser on his outlines.
Yeah, he doesn't have to do as much work anymore.
Yeah, but Yeah. And I mean, the thing with this comic is I've been trying to get to a bad issue so I don't have to read it anymore. And
Haven't got there yet.
As far along as it goes, I'm still on board.
As comic book resources would say, it's a solid 3 stars.
Well, what have you got next?
I got Invisible Republic, which is...
which I haven't read, so don't spoil it too much.
Oh, man, we're up to issue 2. You better get off your ass.
I've got a huge list.
All right. Anyway, Invisible Republic, yet another in our science fiction series of new Image books and other independent publishers, spearheaded by Gabriel Hardman. And I'm assuming Corina Bechko is his...
co-writer. Yes, that's okay. Yes. I didn't know what this was. I want to read it now. I've been reading their comics. Yeah.
Right, right.
As I always give their stuff a shot.
Yeah, they always do a lot of indie stuff. Their wonderful dog epic we talked about a few shows back. And this one now occurs about a brother-sister pair and their transformation into rulers of a planet world. All the struggles these people go to is thought about in a very realistic detail, and the dialogue is good, and the first 2 issues have brought me along. I hope, I think it's 5, maybe more. It can't go on forever, but it's, well, you know, these science fiction epics can't go on forever. But so far, you know, the artwork of Gabriel Hardman is up to its usual standards of magnificence. He's one of the best draftsmen we got working in the business, and he really knows how to draw shit. And his collaborators are just really good on this book. I can highly recommend it if you're into, like, good science fiction stories. I mean, he's put himself up there with Michael Lark and who else would I say? Maybe closing in on Al Williamson. So that's pretty good company indeed.
It is.
Yeah. So read Invisible Republic, people.
And so Ghosted 19 is the one I'm going to talk about right now. And Ghosted 19 is a surprising book, and then maybe it shouldn't be. Maybe we should expect this kind of thing from Ghosted, but it's cool to see that Williamson can still get a surprise in. And he also, he does these intense moments of action in a comic that otherwise is basically a Talking Heads book. There's a lot of action, but most of that talking is substantial, and it's a really nice book. The new artist is the Vladimir Kristic Lacy guy. Not as good as the original guy, but the mood's good. The art's got occasional problems, but the mood's definitely good.
Very photographic. The backgrounds are really nice, and the way the characters live among them is very convincing. He really captures the atmosphere. You're right, though. His limited repertoire with facial expressions kind of hurts the dramatic payoffs. But still, you know, again, Joshua Williamson is very lucky to get coded up with somebody. Is this like a one arc or maybe a fill in? Is this the second issue for Lacey? I don't know. I think it's the first.
I think it's the second issue. Yeah, it's a
It's a little rougher than what we're used to, but still he carries the Ghosted trademark, you know, pretty good.
Well, you know, Ghosted's working out. You know, that book, again, I was just talking about it. Ghosted's approaching year 2, and who would have thought I could have gone this long?
Right. It's one of the few success stories of longevity in the Image line.
There you go, especially since they've lost Profit for the time being.
Oh, yeah, that's right. Yeah, Profit is gone. I don't know if that's ever going to return, but you know, this is one of the few efforts that
they promised it would return. They promised Vernon.
Yeah, comic book companies publish you a lot of things. I'm telling you, 50% of it is good. The rest of it, you can just, I don't know, put in your pipe and smoke it anyway. Anyway, I'm going to do a quickie here of one you haven't familiarized yourself with. Another wonderfully executed, fully realized science fiction media template called Run, Love, Kill by artist or story by Jean Sui, perhaps. I hate to mangle that up, but Eric Kennedy, the artist, also joins on board. And this is a really not well publicized, but really well done science fiction-y type book, again, done to the precise calculations of working. It's helped a lot by the personal art by Eric Kanidi, who does really good distortions. He kind of reminds me of the foreign Filipino artist and his ability to elongate shapes and turn them into kind of a visual ballerina. I mean, even his full-page spreads are done with enough lines and draftsmanship to keep you fully engaged. And the panel-to-panel transitions are nice, and his full control over personal anatomy is pushed to the limits when he does these really exaggerated figures. But the whole universe is artfully depicted here, and the story is engaging about one young lady who's trying to run away from it all in kind of this future dystopian society. And it could be a perfect movie treatment or a TV treatment. There's no way around this, and this seems to be yet another offering. But I tell you, this is another good one. This is like Millar, okay? It's like a real good sugar candy bar, but it's still good. I don't know. It still works, and it's still well executed. So you can do a lot bit worse than do Run, Love, and Kill. But anyway, read that book. But we're going to let you finish off with Frankenstein Underground
number 2. Some beautiful art by whoever that is.
That is Ben Stenbeck.
Absolutely no story by Mike Mignola. Just none.
None.
Frankenstein's monster fights some dinosaurs. And then there are cavemen, except he's in the middle of the earth.
That's true. It takes on a very Edgar Rice Burroughs in the...
Yes, it does. Edgar Rice Burroughs, and then there's some Jules Verne in there. And yeah, except there's no story, and there's no comic here. It's like about 4 pages of stuff. It's really not worth the... If it weren't for the art, it certainly would not be worth it.
Yeah, it'd best be a transitional issue, because the first one was so filled with the interaction between the poor tortured soul of Frankenstein and his one sympathetic person that he met many long years. And it was a real tearjerker in its way for a comic, and it was successfully done by Ben Stenbeck's visuals. Now we learn why the thing's called the Frankenstein Underground, because he relentlessly falls underground, prey to all these different menaces over the 20-odd pages of this book. And while it's nicely drawn and it reminds you of an Edgar Rice Burroughs novel from the 30s, it's not necessarily worth $3.50 as pretty as it is. We recommended the first issue. The second issue takes a serious misstep here. Hopefully they give you a little more meat, you know, in the next time. I don't know. You know, good stuff otherwise.
And now we're out of comics, so we're going to talk about the latest in media, which there's been a ton.
Tell me.
Well, I mean, it's not a comic, but let's start with Star Wars. The preview for Star Wars came out and impressed the entire world, basically.
Yeah, with this.
Including Vernon.
Oh, I like the girl.
Same day, a little bit later, there was the Batman Superman, which did not impress Vernon.
Nope, not at all. Yeah, it's good. How far are you into it?
Only 2. I think I'm watching the 3rd episode tonight.
Ooh, all right. Yeah, my customers have enjoyed it quite a bit, so I think you're in for a fun show on that one.
Yeah.
You know, it's kind of weird. I don't know where to place myself with those Star Trek trailers. I mean, I know Star Wars trailers. On one hand, I know they're designed to create interest for a movie coming out at Christmas time, but I just, I'm not really the target audience. And I look at it and I'm like, okay, it's kind of pretty. And I don't know. I don't know if I want to see Harrison Ford old. I don't know if I want to pay for that. I don't necessarily want to see Carrie Fisher or Mark Hamill old either. You know, I'll probably just wait until it comes out on DVD on that one. You know, I mean, I'll wait. I can wait on that stuff. I'm not excited as some people. Like, I'll go see Batman and Superman, even though it's probably going to be a horrible motion picture because it's directed by Zack Snyder, who kind of pushes the word director around a little bit there.
All right.
Of not narrative missteps, but I'll say like accumulative missteps on The Flash, which kind of took some of the air out of it. But then they managed to get things going again. When they hurried this Zoom plot, I think that's when they keep things going. I got lost on the Queen Bee last time around.
Mm.
It kind of distracted from the momentum. That's the word I'm looking for, is momentum. You know, they're promising the big thing with Flash and Zoom, and I'm kind of worried about that because I don't want to see the destruction of Star Labs at the end, you know. I mean, with all the various hoopla we've had about the characters and what's going to happen to them later after this. I'm like, I don't know if I care for that. I really like Star Labs, and I'm really going to feel bad if it goes away, you know, because it's a nice place for Barry to hang his hat. Not that he mm-hmm. needs to be there, but I just think that character interaction is going to be a part of the show if that goes
yeah.
away. Can they replace it with something I'm interested in? That's the key thing there. And don't forget, it's also the Iron Heights Penitentiary for metahumans. So, it, you know, there's a lot of stories there if they choose to use that. I don't know. We shall see. I'm still on board. The first season of The Flash has been fine.
And
I'd still shoot Iris if she were my girlfriend, though.
Yeah, Iris is getting pretty annoying.
Don't bother me, woman.
I don't know. Is there anything else? Is there a new Ant-Man preview? There's a new Fantastic Four preview. I didn't like it.
Yeah, it looks like Fantastic Four. Who was it? Were you the one suggesting? No, you were not. One of my customers suggested that the actor that plays the Human Torch would have been a better cast as Reed Richards in this because he looks older and more intelligent and more interesting. And I says, oh, you know, that would have been pretty radical, though.
Yeah, maybe, yeah.
Yeah, yeah, I don't know. It was good. We'll see what happens. It looks like it's another 20th Century Fox movie on the dole, though, you know. At least the thing is CGI. CGI is able to do the thing now, so it doesn't look horrible, horrible.
Yeah, I'm withholding my judgment. I actually like the first preview. The second preview I haven't liked very much.
Yeah, too much detail, right?
Yeah, and the detail was bad.
Yeah. That's it. You know, you're like, oh, okay, now you're really pushing me out of the movie theaters. The more mysterious it is, the better off you are.
Right.
Hey, what's the running time? Somebody told me that the Avengers...
Are you going to go see it?
Yeah, probably. I don't go see too many things. I think that's a good one to see in the full bleed picture with the huge things. I mean, I'm not going to do the IMAX thing because I don't want to drive half an hour, but... I'll see this in movie theaters. Yeah, definitely. Because it looks cool. I mean, it's going to be 100 times. I don't want to wait. You know, there's another thing. It's better this way, and you don't want to wait. You know, I mean, that's kind of funny. I appreciate good movies. But, you know, the only thing I'll go see nowadays is these big roller coaster films because that's really the only thing they got going for them is that they're huge and they're loud and they're big. You know what I mean? Do you still go to the movies that much anymore or what?
Not that much. Not
yeah,
you
used to be a big movie goer back
when
you
were dead. I did, but now I'm sort of just
chilling.
It's a pain in the ass, and it's expensive.
Well, and you have to drive somewhere and park and all
that. You
got to
drive somewhere, yeah.
Now, if you're out in the suburbs, it's not so bad because usually movie theaters have parking lots. But if you're in an urban area, you usually are a fend for yourself as far as trying to parking is concerned, and that doesn't always work.
Yeah. I mean, actually here we're pretty lucky on parking, but...
Yeah, not too bad anyway. You know, we had, what was it, 5 Wednesdays this month, so it really stretched the product out, so we, like, got an extra podcast into you all. I mean, that was the point this time. We were keeping up. We're still, I think we're as close to the edge right now as it gets. We're up there. I think we're past Graham McMillan and Jeff Lester right now. Because they're just, yeah, they're usually up there. But you and I, if we keep this up, man, we'll be ahead of them. But I boast too soon, so I should just shut up now while I got a chance. We're pretty up there. We're ahead of CBR by a mile, even though they review things on a basis. They don't review half the things we talk about on this.
Okay.
Thing. Yeah, so I'll put our podcast up there, man. No problem.
All right.
Now you just got
to. There's no tag scene on Avengers 2, so don't wait for it. There you go.
Okay. Really?
There's a middle of the credits one, but not an end one.
So what? You wait till the credits are over and you what?
No, it's midway through the credits, just like last time.
Oh, okay. Just don't do anything differently then. Yeah. Okay, good. Don't panic the herd.
Yeah.
I know my fellow comic dude, he's having a private screening with open bar. And I'm tempted to go. Yeah, but I can't start at like 11 o'clock anymore. I'm too old for that shit. I want to get up the next morning and I got to go to work.
I think didn't he do that last time? Did you go last time?
I did. I was good for shit the next morning. That's why I don't want to do it again. But I can't do that. You know, I got too much to do, my friend.
All right. Well, I think that's about it, everybody.
Yeah, that's it. We're gonna edit out some passion fruit after this. But other than that, we think we got a pretty up-to-date listing of comics there for you. Let's put it that way. And we're going to keep going on that route. Send us in your criticism.
Yeah, do that. Well, thanks for listening, and we'll be back in a couple weeks, or maybe a little bit longer.
Yeah, we'll see how our lives go. That's how it is. But we promise to be honest with you. At least we're there. Ciao, ciao. Yeah.